The sun has gone down at Hangman's Hill, and the ghost at Misery Corner isn't walking tonight. So, welcome to the Weird Tales Radio Show, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore. And now, here's your host, writer, award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and sometime werewolf hunter, Charles Christian.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Weird Tales Radio Show. I'm Charles Christian and thank you very much for tuning in again. This week the show is given over to an interview with Matthew Alper, the author of the book The God Part of the Brain, which examines the issue of whether humans are hardwired to believe in a god, which in turn raises a number of other issues, including how come then there are atheists? Anyway, enough talking from me. Let's get on with the interview. Well, it's my great pleasure to be talking to Matthew Alper, and we're going to be discussing his book that features on the God part of the brain. Now, I suppose the first question to ask you is, I mean, I'm looking here and, you know, some of your background, you were a history teacher in Brooklyn and you've been a tutor in the Philippines and rather intriguingly a truck smuggler in Central Africa.
Yep. Nothing that connects or connects to the reason why I would have written a book as I did. So,
yeah. So what was the founding of the idea for the book? I mean, you didn't just sit down there one day and think, oh, nobody's written a book about this, I'll write a book. What was the sort of, if you like, the inspiration that started you off?
So, true. My prior careers to having written The God Part of the Brain do not add up in any way to someone who would have gone on to write a behavioral neuroscience and philosophy book. More or less, I mean, you know, kind of goes back to my childhood, my formative years, when I first sort of came to terms with my own mortality. It made me instantly curious as to what is the nature of my existence. I had people telling me things like, oh, well, when you die, you're going to go to heaven and be reunited with your family, et cetera. And I was a little bit skeptical about such things. So as I got older, I found myself asking more and more questions in that nature. And as I became a teenager, I began reading a lot more science and a lot more philosophy. I began, as I got even older, experimenting with various things such as transcendental meditation. I began exploring the use of psychedelic drugs. I was kind of on a quest to ascertain whether or not there is a spiritual realm. I wanted to know, I figured, you know, before I pick a career or figure out what I'm doing with this life, I'd like to get to the bottom of such things as whether I am immortal or mortal, whether I have just another, you know, 60, 70 odd years to exist on this planet, and that's the end of it, or if I'm here for all eternity, which probably opens to more options. But I figured, you know, this is something I'd like to get to the bottom of, if at all possible. And in my various explorations, you know, I didn't find anything that I would call conclusive or definitive. I had read a lot of science. I read everything from cosmology to, you know, to molecular biology, trying to sort of leave no stone unturned as to where there might be a clue as to whether or not there might be certain knowledge that would lead to an answer one way or the other. And again, came up kind of empty-handed. None of my drug experiences, as interesting as they were, led me to feel that I had, you know, participated in anything that led me to conclusive knowledge of a transcendental realm. I knew that I'd altered states of consciousness, but couldn't really confirm that it was anything other than that. And as I got into my 20s and, you know, was at the age where I did have to kind of have a job and pay bills and stuff, I kind of let go of my quest. I kind of came to the conclusion that it was an unanswerable, that it was just one of those things I would have to live with. I kind of, you know, saw myself more or less as an atheist. I didn't feel I had any reason to believe in a transcendental reality, but at the same time, it was troublesome to me that I didn't have any conclusive evidence that there wasn't either. So I was sort of an agnostic leaning atheist.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, so really there was, you know, that kind of went on. And then I was a high school history teacher. It was at a really, you know, crummy school in Brooklyn, New York. And I realized, all right, like, I don't think I want to sort of do this for the rest of my life. So I started trying to come up with another plan. And I've always been into movies. So I bought a book, How to Write a Screenplay. And I wrote a screenplay and I ended up selling it to this German film company. So I lived in Munich for a while and they offered me a job there. And I told them that I would accept, that I was suddenly going to find myself living in Munich as a screenwriter and working on editing other people's screenplays as well as writing more of my own. And as I kind of accepted this job, I was, you know, kind of lamenting that evening, like, all right, I guess I'm just sort of part of the workaday world now. And, you know, those philosophical questions that I used to have, I guess, are a thing of the past, you know, sort of part of my childhood experience and nothing more. And I decided, all right, you know, but just in honor of my past and my, you know, prior quest, I decided every 5 years, I'm just going to reopen the question. Have I come across anything new that leads me to any certain knowledge of God? And I said, all right, and I typed the question out on the computer. I was sitting on my laptop working on a screenplay. And I was like, yeah, no, I haven't witnessed any miracles. I haven't just uncovered any new information that leads me to certain knowledge one way or the other. And it was at that point that I sort of had a bit of an epiphany. The light bulb went off.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden I had my aha moment as I looked on the computer screen and I said, wait a second, there actually is something that I can say with certain knowledge of God. I was like, it's an interesting angle. It wasn't kind of what I was expecting, but who knows? I'm going to work with this for now. And I was like, there it is right in front of me on the computer screen. There's something I can say with certain knowledge of God. It's a word. If I can hear it in Braille, I can touch it. It is definitively a thing. It is a word. So I was like, all right, with all the science that I used to study, what does science say about words? Well, they're a human concoction. They come from the human brain. We have language centers, which have given us this capacity. So I was like, all right, that's interesting. What else does, you know, might I be able to conclude from this? I was like, well, moreover than it's a word, it's also a word that seems to exist in every human culture in some form. Certainly the word soul or spirit exists in every culture. So I was like, all right, well, what does science have to say about universal behavioral patterns? So I was like, well, from my recollection, it suggests that it's an inherent part of, it's an instinct, an inherent part of the brain. And at that moment, sort of the light bulb went off and I wrote on a piece. I was like, oh my goodness, it's coming from within. It's a perceptual thing. And I wrote on a scrap of paper, the God part of the brain, and that became my next project. And I started investigating more thoroughly what does all of this mean?
Mm-hmm.
So to sort of reach back a little, so, you know, a little sort of standard Darwinian genetics that I, you know, had studied, basically for any universal trait that any species possesses, we know that it's, you know, there's a behavioral component. So the fact that all humans have a nose in the middle of their face, or cats have whiskers, or monarch butterflies have a specific pattern on their wings, not an accident. It's written in the DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a guy, Edward O. Wilson, who came up with a science he called sociobiology, where he basically said the same principle applies to universal behaviors. the fact that all beavers build dams, or cats meow, or dogs bark, or that you, all human cultures have language, not an accident. It's written in the DNA. These are inherited instincts. Now, given that all behaviors are generated from the brain, this would mean, for instance, that, let's take in the case of all cats, that somewhere in all cats' brains, there's a very specific region that would be responsible for generating particularly the capacity for the cat to meow, what we could call the meow part of its brain. Similarly, with humans, the fact that all human cultures have had language, have communicated linguistically, would suggest that they're, the same is true for humans. And with the help of neuroscience, we know of the Wernicke's area, the Broca's area, the angular gyrus, specific parts of the brain responsible for generating our language capacities. So it was at that point that I applied that same reasoning to the fact that every human culture, no matter how isolated, has believed in some form of a transcendental reality, of a spiritual world, and of deities or entities that rule those worlds. It suddenly dawned on me that there must be a, what I put in quotes, a God part of the brain, or a part or parts that are responsible for generating what we call spiritual and religious consciousness. And that was sort of the pivotal point that you know, gave me the start of writing this book. And it was from there, you asked what was the impetus, that was the impetus. And from there, I, you know, took off 2 years and did a lot of research. Like I said, this was sort of a life quest for me, trying to determine, get it, you know, come up with a conclusion to this particular question. So even though it might not make sense in terms of the past that I had prior to writing the book, it was something that I was, you know, pursuing of my on my own, so that once I did come up with this initial conclusion, I was able to pull from a lot of science and philosophy that I had read throughout my life that sort of led to me putting together this book, suggesting that essentially humans are genetically predisposed to a belief system, that there are parts of our brain that generate what we call spiritual and religious experiences. In a nutshell, I basically write that this is the manifestation of an evolutionary adaptation, something that emerged in our species to help us survive our unique awareness of death, so that it's a coping mechanism that evolved in us to basically help us survive existential anxiety, being that we're the only animal with self-conscious awareness, therefore the only animal aware of our own inevitable deaths. So there you have, that's the essential, hypothesis.
Yeah. Taking it forward, what evidence did you find to support the hypothesis? Is there something in the brain? Is there an organ? I mean, I know some people talk about the pineal gland and things like that. Is there some feature of the brain where this God part lurks?
Yep, absolutely. So, you know, the notion of the pineal gland, that was kind of a, sort of before any of this new science came out, that was something that was suggested by people as maybe like the font of our spiritual, you know, existences, almost like where the spirit resides. It has nothing to do with the pineal gland. That was supposition by people who were just sort of trying to conclude that, sort of make a connection between our spiritual selves and our physical brains. I, on the other hand, am suggesting there is no spiritual self. At this point, I'm a hardcore atheist. I don't believe that there is a spirit or soul, an afterlife, transcendental or supernatural entities of any kind, that all of these, that every form of what we would call magical thinking, belief in luck, belief in extraterrestrials, all of these various things are just manifestations of these parts of the brain that compel us to have beliefs in some form, to have faith in some form of a transcendental reality. And it gives us a sense of hope that even though we know the physical body will die, that this other part of us will persevere. So in regard to what evidence has come out since, So essentially, I break it into a series of parts. So first of all, there's the sociobiological argument. And that's what I kind of summed up earlier, which is essentially there is a law that for every cognitive trait, any behavior that's universal to any species seems to be able to be connected to parts of the brain that generate these experiences. In terms of then the neuroscience that's been conducted since this, in terms of trying to figure out if this is real and where it might be coming from, there's been a number of studies done basically showing that sort of spiritual perception and religious perception come from a variety of parts of our brain. It's not as concise as that there's any one part. So for instance, they've done studies where they've taken people in the midst of meditation or prayer, in the midst of having what they felt to be a spiritual experience, feeling connected to some form of a higher power, and they've put them in various scans to see what's happening in the brain. And it seems like it's basically a series of events taking place. So for instance, regardless of what culture you come from, if you meditate or pray, it seems there's like a, you know, a string of descriptors that are universal to every religion, to every culture. So for instance, one of them is if we meditate or pray to our gods, whoever that god might be, one of the universal descriptors is a feeling of a sense of tranquility, serenity, bliss. One of the things that happens when you meditate or pray that they find is that the brain's amygdala, which is part of our limbic system, which is responsible for generating fear and anxiety, gets a decreased blood flow, which means that so basically all of our normal anxieties and fears are dissipated. We're given to a sense of tranquility, of bliss. Another descriptor is a loss of sense of time and space, of feeling like this sort of amorphous sense of being one with a whole. That can be, you know, correlated to the fact that they found that the brain's parietal lobe, where spatial and temporal consciousness is derived, also gets a decreased blood flow. So our normal sense of time and space dissipates, and we're left feeling, again, this more amorphous sense of being one with a whole. And essentially, all of these experiences can be correlated to things happening in the brain. That they've found through numerous studies at this point, conducted all over the world. And now I break the experience, basically the phenomena of, you know, the human capacity to believe in some form of a transcendental reality into two components. I write about the spiritual and the religious. And that these are basically two separate instincts coming from different parts of the brain. So where spirituality is more an experiential phenomena, something we feel, it's a feeling of connectedness to the one, of what we describe as God consciousness. That is coming from a concatenation of a series of parts of the brain. Whereas and that's an experience we have that makes us feel connected to some higher power. Religiosity, I write, is an instinct separate from spirituality, which stems apparently from other parts of the brain, which is more about feeling connected to some institution. It's sort of like a almost tribal instinct that makes us feel connected to a certain religious institution from which we derive a series of customs, of rituals that give us a sense of meaning and purpose in our lives. And that seems to distinctly come from, again, based on scientific research that I have not personally done, but that I've compiled. Particularly, a lot of it's been done by a guy, Dr. Ramachandran, who's a neuroscientist who essentially was working with epilepsy. And he found that amongst epileptics, there were certain groups whose epilepsy originated from the temporal lobe. And they're called temporal lobe epileptics. And he found that unlike other epileptics whose epileptic seizures originate from different parts of the brain, those who have, you know, a deficiency of myelin sheathing in their temporal lobe, and that's where their seizures are derived, tend to be hyper-religious people. He found this phenomena that people who are temporal lobe epileptics have a high likelihood of being very religious people, hyper-religious people, and that during their seizures tend to describe their seizures as religious experiences.
Right, yes.
So that's another category of sort of research that's been done to show that there's a connection between religiosity and the brain.
Mm-hmm.
They have everything from, like, you know, they found that certain authors like Dostoevsky, who was prone to epileptic seizures, they're now suggesting was probably a temporal lobe epileptic, because he often wrote about the manifestations of his seizures as being hyper-religious experiences. And I think it was in his book, The Idiot, where he has a passage where he says something like, you know, you common folk who don't have these religious seizures will never know what it is to truly be connected to God. They've also done, now historians have gone back and done research and found that there's reason to believe that everything from Muhammad to Joan of Arc were epileptics, and therefore possibly temporal lobe epileptics, who a lot of their religious visions, etc., were derived from these parts of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a guy, Dr. Persinger, another neuroscientist. He did studies on people who have suffered from traumatic brain injuries and found that something like 19% of young people who have suffered traumatic brain injury during their teenage years, grow up to be hyper-religious people, tend to have these, you know, these sort of fits of religiosity. Again, connecting religious experience to the brain. Another of the sort of main channels of evidence that I found is the genetic argument. And what they've done in terms of proving genetics is they've done a lot of identical twin studies. Particularly, I think one of the biggest ones was University of Virginia did a study of 40,000 sets of identical and fraternal twins. And what they found is, whereas obviously fraternal twins do not share DNA, they just mm-hmm. come out of the same womb at the same time,
yeah.
Identical twins share DNA. So they did a correlative study between behaviors of both fraternal and identical twins separated at birth.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found was there is a 50% higher likelihood that, and it's not just amongst religiosity, but other experiences and phenomena, behavioral phenomena as well, but particularly amongst religiosity, they found that amongst identical twins separated at birth, that there was a 50% higher likelihood over their fraternal counterparts that they would share religious attitudes. So if one who grew up in, you know, one part of the country tended to be extremely religious, there was a 50% higher likelihood that his identical twin would also, as compared to fraternal twins, would also be extremely religious. And on the flip side, that if one tended to have no religious inclinations whatsoever, that it was 50% more likely that his identical twin would share that behavior, as opposed to compared to, again, the fraternal twin. So there's also now sort of genetic evidence to show that this tendency towards spiritual belief or religiosity is also genetic in nature.
Right.
And the last sort of channel or argument that I refer to as the ethnogenic argument. So ethnogens or ethnobotany is a science basically dealing with cultures that have used various plants or substances to induce a religious experience.
Right.
So the mere fact that there is, you know, historical evidence to show that cultures from all over the world, dating back to prehistoric times, have been using a variety of plants to induce a religious experience would suggest that the fact that a plant could induce this would mean that it's neuro, that it's chemical in nature, as opposed to like we're actually having a vision of some actual transcendental reality. There's a connection now to the chemistry, neurochemistry, and religious experience. Again, also showing that the phenomena is tied to our biologies as opposed to representative of knowledge of an actual reality beyond us, transcendent of us. Gotcha. So those are the four essential arguments that have now been sort of rooted in various studies to suggest that, again, this is all biological in nature.
Right.
And there's plenty more, but I mean, you know, I don't want to spend this whole interview going through a book's worth of all of the data that's been brought up. You know, they've done now studies on near-death experiences of the neurotransmitters involved and why that phenomena takes place. And again, all of these religious phenomena, what's most important is that it's evident to sort of anyone who has a basic understanding of human anthropology that all of these various religious phenomena are universals, that we could go to, you know, the ends of the earth and whatever culture, whether we find, you know, sort of, you know, native tribes in, lost in the Amazon, or, you know, Aboriginal tribes in Australia, or in any, you know, major developed society, that we find that these are universals, that that humans as a species tend to build shrines to various deities, that all of these phenomena, speaking in tongues, religious conversion, near-death experiences, they're all the same all around the globe, regardless of what your religious belief is.
You took all that as part of your research, and then where did you go with it?
Well, then I wrote a book.
Yes.
I mean, so where did I go with it in terms of my own sort of philosophical take on these things? Like, well, I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, I mean, in terms of putting that together for the basis for your book, as these are ideas that are already in not necessarily the public domain, but certainly in the academic domain.
Well, they weren't at the time. See, I wrote The God Part of the Brain in 1997.
Yeah.
There was none of this was out there. There was no science around it. As a matter of fact, if you look at, you know, the sort of big books that are now out, whether it's Dawkins, The God Delusion, etc., I'm in their bibliographies. They're not in mine because their books didn't exist for another decade.
Right.
So this writing sort of predated this whole new boom in a field of what they're calling neurotheology. Personally, in my book, I call it Intro to Biotheology because it's more than just a brain science. It's a genetic science. You know, it's a plant science. It's a brain science. It's a behavioral science. It's an anthropological science. It's pretty comprehensive. So I call it biotheology. And that's what I did when I came up with this initial idea. You know, I sort of strung all the research together. You know, one of the things that I realized I had to add to the book for it to make sense was that here I am sort of hypothesizing that this is all part of some evolutionary adaptation that emerged in our species, and evolutionary adaptations don't emerge for no reason. They all have sort of a raison d'etre.
Yeah.
You know, there's a purpose. They have an adaptive function. So one of the things I had to come up with is, you know, well, what's the function of this? Why, of all the various species, would we have evolved this very strange tendency to believe in transcendental realities, particularly if they're not real?
Yeah.
So my approach to that was, well, I thought, okay, well, since this is a human function, let me sort of isolate humans. What do we possess? What makes us unique from the other animals that we may have evolved this? You know, I went through the various list of things that make us unique. We're a linguistic animal. No other creature is. We are a musical animal. We're a mathematical animal. You know, we have these various traits that have emerged in us Other animals might have incipient versions of these behaviors. I mean, you know, birds tweet. We could say it's a bird song, but they're not composing original music. Other animals may count high enough to be able to know how many, you know, sort of are in their litter.
Yeah.
But they can't do sophisticated mathematical equations. That's a strictly human capacity. Mm-hmm. I thought, so what are the unique human capacities that make us stand out that may have triggered the evolution of this trait? And the one that sort of jumped out to me as what sort of stands out as the most unique trait that humans possess that no other animal does is self-conscious awareness. That we possess parts of our brain that enable us the capacity to be aware of our own existences. And I write about that sort of, you know, the reason for that, you know, that self-conscious awareness not only is one of those traits that makes us unique as a species, but it's also that trait which has sort of positioned us as the most powerful species on Earth. Mm-hmm. Because what self-conscious awareness did was it made us the first creature with the capacity for what I call self-modification. So, for instance, let's say another ice age comes. Every other species on Earth will have to passively sit back and wait however long it takes, millions of years, to develop a thicker coat of fur for natural selection to take place. Humans, with the advent of self-conscious awareness, have transcended the process of natural selection. So if an ice age comes, for instance, we don't have to sit passively back and wait for generations to develop these traits that will enable us to be more survivable in this new environment. We can say, I am cold, and we can do something about it. Within a couple of hours, we can sew ourselves a coat of fur. Mm-hmm. So should we look up at the sky at birds flying and say, hey, it'd be really neat to fly? Again, we don't have to passively sit back and wait however long it might be for us to grow wings, even though that's not a likely scenario anyway. But because of self-conscious awareness, we can do something about it. We can build wings. So through self-conscious awareness, we've been able to modify ourselves to suit any possible environment, to go down to the depths of the seas or even to other planets, to the moon. We have now transcended the process of natural selection. You know, there's all these, you know, there are stories about like, what will humans look like in 1,000 years from now? And pictures with big veiny green heads, et cetera.
Yes.
We're done evolving. We have transcended the process of natural selection itself. We are completely baked. If we decide that it would be to our advantage to have bigger brains, we'll build them. They're called computers. Our brains are not going to grow. We have all the capacity we need to suit any possible environment. So here we have this new trait that comes, you know, that evolves in us, that emerges in us, and makes us the most powerful species on Earth. And yet, like with most good things, it came with a catch. And the catch was, now we know about that horrific thing called death.
Yeah.
Suddenly, whereas in the history of the evolution of all life forms, we basically, all life is wired with the primary motivation of self-preservation, to live. And all life forms, up until humans, have been wired with the sort of the standard defense of when confronted with anything that threatens our existence to either fight or flee.
Yeah.
And suddenly an animal comes into the picture that is aware of its own mortalities to the extent that we become aware of the fact that there's nothing to fight and there's nowhere to run. Game over. Checkmate. We're dead. We can build the biggest fortress in the world. Can't protect us. There's nowhere to run and there's nothing to fight. So suddenly humans become the first animal to experience existential anguish.
Right.
And I believe that it was as a result of the debilitating nature of existential angst that nature provided us with this cognitive modification that compels us to believe that even though we know the physical body will die, that we are going to lose everything we've ever had or loved, including our own selves. But with that certain knowledge, nature has provided us with this palliative mechanism that allows us to feel that even though the body will die, that there's this other component residing within us, this spirit. And that though the body will die, the other component, the transcendental component within us, will persevere. Ergo, problem solved. There's physical death, but it has no real meaning because our souls or spirits will persevere in some form, which is, you know, indicated by the fact that every human culture, no matter how isolated, has engaged in some form of a funerary ritual, mm-hmm. usually a burial ritual, but sometimes it involves burning or other things, but some form of a funerary ritual where we dispose of our deceased with a ritual that anticipates sending that person's spirit to some next realm.
Yeah.
So even in prehistoric times, when they've unearthed humans that were buried, they find that they've been buried, for instance, with relics, something no other animal does. The only other animal that there was physical evidence to have done such a thing was Neanderthal man,
yes.
who might have also had some incipient capacity for a sense of spirit. So again, suggesting that we're burying the dead with things that were sacred to them that they will now possess in the afterlife, for instance.
Yeah.
But the notion, again, of an afterlife is a universal that has existed in every culture.
Right.
So that was sort of the next thing that I felt needed to be solved in terms of coming up with a sort of comprehensive hypothesis that would explain what this is and why it is.
You're listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian.
This does prompt a question. How does the God part of the brain work with somebody who is, for example, an agnostic, an atheist?
Excellent question. Prompted chapter 11, Why Are There Atheists? And again, you know, a question that occurred to me, like, okay, now I have something else I have to contend with. Why? And as I thought about it, I realized I came up with a conclusion, which is that I found that so essentially for every trait that is, again, universal to a species, any even physical trait. Let's say we were going to take the population of any given 10,000 people, let's say on an isolated island, and we were going to measure them for the physical trait of height.
Mm-hmm.
They would fall into a bell curve.
Yeah.
The average person would be what we would call average height within that society. And yet, because of genetic variation, we would fall into a bell curve where on the tapering extremes, you would have a certain subsection of people who would be born excessively short and others born excessively tall.
Yeah.
The same principle applies to cognitive traits. So let's take something like musicality. Humans are a musical animal. They are now finding that there are parts of the brain that generate our musical capacities. It's a part of our nature. So if we take that cognitive trait, for instance, we'll find the same thing happens. We fall into a bell curve. That if you took any given population of people, the average person in that grouping would fall into the bulge of the bell curve and, mm-hmm. and possess what we would call average musical potential.
Yeah.
If you took me to any continent on Earth and brought me with a tribe that was singing a song or clapping a rhythm, I could join right in. I could communicate with them musically.
Mm-hmm.
I would possess what we would call average musical potential. However, again, on the tapering extremes of that bell curve, you have some people born tone deaf.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side of the curve, you have people born musically savant. You know, basically people who at age 5, if you play them a Beethoven sonata, on hearing it once, can sit down and play it note for note in perfect timing. So again, this is the mechanics of the brain. And the mechanics of the brain seem to unfold because, again, due to genetic variance, the phenomenon of genetic variation into bell curves. So I applied that bell curve notion to spirituality and religiosity, suggesting that though most humanity falls into the bulge of the bell curve and has what we would call average spiritual or religious sort of inclinations, a belief that there's something else out there, mm-hmm. on the tapering extremes, you have some people born on one end who are, tend to be hyper-religious, who from a very early age are reciting passages from their Bible, whatever that Bible might be, who are very involved in their religious communities and religious thinking, who are even obsessed with it. And on the other side of the curve, I believe that there are people who just don't care. They just don't have an inclination. It doesn't play a role in their mental life. They're more interested in sports or music or other secular things. They just don't really have strong religious or spiritual inclinations. Now, again, I'm not suggesting that all of our behavior is guided by pure nature. Obviously, there's the nurture component. Mm-hmm. So how we're raised, the environment we're raised in, will also play a role. So in the case of, let's say, musicality, where you have, for instance, in the case of like a Mozart, who was probably born with savantish tendencies, but happened to be raised by a man who was obsessed with music, you have a nice combination of the two working together. However, I'm sure throughout human history, there have been Mozarts born millions of times over who weren't born into the right time in the right environment. So, for instance, indentured servants who, you know, other slaves noticed had a, you know, whistled really beautifully while toiling the fields, but we'll never know their names and they'll never write symphonies just because they weren't born in the right place to do so.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, there are savants, there are geniuses of every form that have been born throughout human history that we'll never know. Probably geniuses who are smarter than any Einstein or Mozart that we'll ever know of, who just weren't, again, born into the environment that would have led them to realize their true potential.
Yeah.
And then again, on the other extreme, you've got the tone deaf. So I basically believe that some people are born spiritually and religiously tone deaf. They're not as inclined.
Where do you put yourself on that bell curve?
I'm not quite sure because I was, you know, obsessed enough at an early age with trying to get to, you know, resolve this problem. So I was really, I gave it a lot of thought and I did a lot of sort of experiments on myself trying to figure out like, where is my thinking coming from? And really trying to determine, am I a physical being or a spiritual being? So on one end, I feel like maybe I had a strong spiritual propensity, but I was born into a secular culture, just New York City in the 1970s kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, my parents, my family is Jewish, but completely secular. My parents I wasn't raised really religiously in any way. So I would say I was raised in a secular setting. And at the same time, I've always been a skeptic. So even when my mother tried to assuage me when I, you know, was crying when I came to the realization that my cat was going to die when I was 5 years old and I was hysterically crying. And then all of a sudden it occurred to me, wait, it's not just my cat. It's all of us. Oh, no, my mommy's going to die, too. I almost passed out. But when my mother said, oh, it's okay, we're all going to be in heaven one day, and she doesn't even believe that, but I think she was telling me because I was a child and I was terrified. And even if from an early age, I was like, I don't know. It sounds like it might be more part of that whole Santa Claus conspiracy, other fairy tales that I'm supposed to believe that I'm not quite buying into. So I have a very strong skeptical nature. And at the same time, I was very curious as to trying to come up with a solution to this problem. And I was very driven towards reading a lot about sort of scientific versus spiritual realities. So I'm not really sure where I fall, to be honest.
Right.
I know at this point I am a hardened atheist. You know, my secular reasoning part of my brain has sort of dominated any inclination I may have ever had towards a spiritual belief. But I never really had any strong spiritual belief. I mean, I know as a child, I remember having conversations with God in my bed. But probably after even a few years, by the time I was 10 and he never answered back,
I was like,
I don't know if any of this is real anyway.
Yeah.
So I stopped having conversations with any God. Instead, when I would stub my toe or bad things would happen, I would give God the finger, figuring like, well, if he's in charge of everything, why did I have to stub my toe and have this pain go zooming up into my brain? So the last relationship I had with God was giving him the finger a lot. And then I even got bored with that. So
do you think the God part of the brain can also dominate how people act in terms of, say, morality, being good, which then sort of prompts where do people who are, I don't know, existentially evil, where do they fit mm-hmm. into it? Do they lack that, or?
Well, again, another excellent question, which brings us to chapter 13, the guilt and morality function. So, you know, here I was trying to sort of put together an entire philosophy, and it had to be comprehensive, and I had to be able, you know, ready to answer a lot of questions. And one of the sort of essential questions, revolving around religious belief is, what is the nature of evil? Like I could string together a whole bunch of theories about the brain, but if I can't explain the nature of evil, then, you know, again, another unknown. So, you know, because we think of good versus evil as almost these transcendental qualities.
Mm.
So I started to investigate the neuroscience underlying morality. And what I found was that, you know, there's research out there to suggest, a lot of it done by a guy, Antonio Damasio, who writes on the neural nature of morality. So one of the first instances that sort of yielded this science was this character Gage. In the early 1900s, while being involved in making, I think he was laying railroad tracks, and there was an explosion, and it sent the metal rod through his skull.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't remove it, and he lived his life like that. However, he went from being a married man, a husband, a father, known to be an upstanding member of society, and he, once he recovered, became sociopathic, an incorrigible gambler, liar, cheat, thief, etc. And they retained his skull after he died, and since then, a whole science has come around based around the neuroscience of moral reasoning. And what they've found is, and they've done studies, everything from with people with traumatic brain injuries,
mm-hmm.
To, you know, tumors that have affected various parts of the brain. And what they found is that there are parts of the brain that generate moral reasoning. And so essentially, again, what we consider, you know, this notion of existential evil, it's not existential. It's just part of human nature. So essentially, all, and this is true of most mammalian species, we are social organisms. We thrive in groups. We're not independent beings that are like lone creatures. A lot of mammalian species operate in harems and groups, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly primates do. They're not individual creatures living solitary existences. And obviously that's for the pure reasoning of strength in numbers. However, so we are social organisms, which means we have to operate as a group. And yet we have to thrive as individuals. So humans are basically born with two instincts that are constantly at odds with one another, which are selfish instincts versus altruistic instincts, both generated from certain regions in the brain. And again, in light of that sort of cognitive bell curve, some of us are born with more tendencies towards sociopathy, and others are born with more of a sense towards altruistic behaviors. Most of us are born sort of somewhere in that middle ground.
Yeah.
So what I found was, again, the answer to the problem of evil, again, resided in the brain. That what we call moral reasoning, that we have a combination of things going on. So one is, I call the chapter the guilt and morality function. Part of it revolves around guilt, the sense of guilt and shame that humans have. It's a universal. There's no culture on earth that you can go to that don't understand the concept of guilt or shame. It is a human mechanism. And the point of that mechanism is, again, for a social organism to thrive, there have to be certain inherent behaviors that cause us to feel shame, that they're almost like checks that we have amidst ourselves that make us think, like, as we're reaching out to sort of steal that muffin in the window, a part of our brain that we often attribute to, you know, our religious character is really our neurophysiological character at work saying, don't do it. It's not the right thing.
Yeah.
You wouldn't want someone to do it to you. Don't do it to them.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we've got these structures in the brain. And again, like I said, there's a tons of neurophysiological research out there at this point showing that how traumatic brain injury can affect those parts of the brain. And they actually did a study and found that, I think they did a study on people in America who were on death row, like some of the worst criminals. And they did did brain scans, and they found that there were distinct either deficiencies or traumatic brain injuries causing atrophy to parts of the brain that were responsible for moral reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
So again, the question of evil, good versus evil, is not a divine battle. It's a neurophysiological battle that we fight within our own heads all the time. And we either veer towards selfish behaviors and tend to be more sociopathic. So again, if we're going to look at human behavior in such a way, it's almost like there is no free will. Like if you were born to be sociopathic, it's a tragedy. It wasn't your own making. It wasn't like, you know, we grew up and by the age of 10 or whatever we were at a crossroad and we thought, am I going to go good or am I going to go evil? And that we have this sort of transcendental capacity to choose evil over good, or good over evil for that matter. In which case, if we're going to look at criminality that way, makes one think that we need to sort of take another look at the way we, you know, work our penal system. The mere word penal implies punishment. And should we be punishing, like wanting to harm? It's almost like that kind of vindictive thinking is as weak as people who were born with an unfortunate predilection towards criminal behavior. It's not to sort of negate the environmental influence, because that's part of it too. I'm sure most people, if they were raised by, you know, by sociopaths, by seasoned criminals, one can just look at the family of those who lead my nation at the moment. It's a family thing. It's a family affair. You know, so between the nature and nurture aspects of these things, we can sort of take away the question of evil from divine inspiration to, again, just natural causes.
Now, Since you wrote the book, which, as you say, was 23 years ago now, have your own views changed? I mean, other than the usual thing of any author that you read something, you think, oh, I'd write it differently now. But, you know, have your own thoughts evolved in any way?
Sure. So when I first wrote the book, when I first put it out in 97, it has since, it went through, I had a self, because I have no, again, you read a little bit about my prior experience. I have no credentials in neuroscience or any science for that matter. I have a degree in philosophy, partly attained in University of North London. I was there for 2 years. So I am a little bit of an Anglophile. I should put that out there. So anyway, when I first self-published the book, because I quickly realized that the publishing world was going to continue to snub me, and I opened Rogue Press and I self-published the book, but I started getting on radio shows, and then the book started selling, and eventually I sold it to a publisher, and then it went into numerous languages, etc. But before that, when I had total control of the book, you know, after my first edition, my thoughts were still evolving.
Yeah.
So, for instance, I think the chapter "Why Are There Atheists" was not in the first edition, for instance, nor were other chapters. So within the breadth of about 5 years of having self-published, I went through like 6 editions.
Yeah.
I kept adding.
Yeah.
Then I sold the book, and I added one chapter to that. It was called "Why."
We'll have the concluding 15 minutes or so of that interview next time. But until then, it just remains for me, Charles Christian, to say thank you very much for listening in, and I'll hope you'll join me again same time next week. Till then, stay well, stay weird, stay different, and stay safe.
Black Shuck, the demon dog of East Anglia, is baying at the moon, which means it's time for us to go. You've been listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore. You can keep in touch with us online at www.weirdtalesradio.com, by email to weirdtales@icloud.com, and on Twitter at Christian Uncut. Join us again next week for another edition of the Weird Tales radio show. Good night.